And who does Michael deserve?
Someone who will cherish him, who will be faithful. Someone for whom he will be the sun and the moon and the stars.
What fucking Bette Davis movie are you living in?
You're listening to the Still Queer as Folk podcast. Each week we take down an episode of Showtime's Queer as Folk TV show to find out if it still holds up 17 years later. I'm Patrick Randall.
And I'm Matt Dominguez.
This episode is called Surprise Kill.
It first aired in the U.S. on April 22nd, 2001, and worldwide on May 7th, 2001.
It was directed by our old friend Russell Mulcahy, who directed the first four episodes of the series.
Welcome back, Russell.
I missed him. Mulcahy was a music video director in the 80s, and all of his episodes have extended musical interludes in them, so hopefully we'll get at least one or two, sorry, four, in tonight's episode.
This episode had four writers. Story was by showrunners Ron Cohen and Daniel Lipman, and the teleplay was by Jason Schaefer and Jonathan Tollins, writers we've seen before. This is basically the starting lineup of the Queer as Folk in terms of the staff talent.
Interestingly enough, this is the very first episode that had both story and teleplay credits. The Writers Guild of America has pretty elaborate rules about how writers get credited. And in this episode, Cohen and Lipman came up with a story idea, and then Schaefer and Tollins wrote the final shooting script, hence the teleplay credit.
For the synopses, for Showtime, Justin faces a crisis when he must choose which college to enter.
Quite the crisis.
The art school he desperately wants to attend, or Dartmouth, which will please his father, which was he really interested in pleasing his father?
We haven't seen Craig Taylor in a while, have we?
I don't care to. Mm. Michael and David's flirtations with infidelity are revealed.
Yes.
Ted allows a strung out Blake to move into his condo.
Attaboy, Ted.
The IMDb synopsis. Brian discovers David at the baths.
The baths.
Yeah, spoiler. Justin finds out his parents are getting a divorce. Ted reconnects with Blake. A hunk from Babylon hits on Michael. Mm,
a hunk from Babylon.
A hunk of Babylon.
This episode, the theme that we came up with when we were talking before when we got to the studio was trust. How these two couples and different people in the episode learn to trust each other, or we see trust broken. This is a theme that the show kind of deals with pretty often. This one is a little more blatant. So let's get started with this one. In true Russell Mulcahy fashion, we open with a music video at Babylon.
And it's a country western night?
Cowboys. Cowboys and chaps and jock straps.
Whew.
They weren't really jock straps. They were more like shiny synthetic pouches.
Yeah, they weren't securing anything.
They matched the guns. So it starts out, and even Ted is dancing, which makes it a definite music video. There's a really nice intro montage from Russell Mulcahy. There's hunky, shirtless men dancing. There's cowboys. They have guns. They're shooting into the air. I don't think you can like have fake guns at the club
anymore.
It was a thematic night at Babylon, to say the least. And one of the hunky men comes across, and Michael says,
"Pardon me, but you happen to be a quarterback?"
"No, what?
You intercepted me like I was a football.
When I see what I want, I grab it and I run with it."
The man like hooked his hand onto Michael's ass and spun him around the dance floor to next thing you know, he is at the bar. And it's like, how did he make it himself away across the bar?
He do-si-do'd Michael all the way off the dance floor up to the bar. I did like that shooting though, because it was very music video and it was very choreographed. Great blocking on it as they thread through the crowd. The camera tracks with them really well and you get a lot of background eye candy. So that's where Russell Mulcahy really shows his stuff when he's doing these music video style scenes.
You know, we see this hunk, you know, hit on Michael, and Michael tries to make it clear, like, oh, no, I'm in a relationship. I can't do anything, because hunk is not shy about it. He says, let's go to the back room and exchange numbers.
Double entendre.
That's not even double entendre. That's just on
entendre. Fuck. Do you think he wanted to top Michael?
I think there's nothing else you can do but top Michael. Fun fact, hunk is literally credited as hunkalicious for this
episode. Is he really?
He is hunkalicious.
I wrote down just hunk. So I was close.
You were very close. But yeah, he is hunkalicious, which, I mean, no arguments here. He was an incredibly good-looking man.
Brian lets us know that Justin has been accepted to Dartmouth.
Who's a college man? Little Justin's been accepted to Dartmouth. Oh, an Ivy Leaguer. Mumsy and Daddy must be so proud. I decided not to go.
He's going to go to art school, or this whole like dilemma for Justin's introduced on the dance floor at Babylon.
Right. Yeah. Everyone else is dealing with relationship or trust issues, and he's just trying to figure out which college to go to. Because remember, he's 18.
He's in high school.
He's still in high school.
The St. James Academy. Here's a moment that I thought that you were going to be waiting for, Matt. But then I realized, wait a minute, this guy fell off your radar. That's Bad Boy Blake showing back
up. Yes.
You used to have such a hard-on for him in those first couple of episodes.
Well, he wasn't even in a couple of episodes. I was interested in him when he showed interest in Ted, and I was rooting for that. I was like, look, Ted, you can attract a man just in general. And I was immediately turned off when I saw how Blake handled the overdose.
And also, as soon as Dr. David entered the show, you'd never spoke of Blake again.
Well, because Blake disappeared, so there was no reason to talk about Blake. But here, Blake has re-entered the picture. He sees Ted and rushes down. And the way Mulcahy shot this, I thought was pretty great. Clearly, Blake is tweaking. He is on something.
Mm-hmm.
Anytime he is intercepted from being physically close to Ted, often by Emmett, it's like the camera is like attached to Blake and moves with him, and it's all very stylized movement, and he's like not getting the hint as much as, you know, Emmett has tried to stop him from doing anything to Ted, because again, you know, Ted almost died in his 40-minute coma.
I wrote down that Emmett handled the blocking and tackling of
that. But it actually reminds me of it was a few years ago. I was at Roscoe's after Market Days, you know, Market Days being a big celebration
in Chicago
near the end of the summer in Chicago, in Boys Town. And I went into Roscoe's to dance. And I know I did a lot of crazy things when I was 25, right?
That was last week, right?
And last week and 4 years ago. And
cheers.
There was this guy. Much like Blake, shirtless, thin, but attractive.
22-inch waist.
Basically, comes up to me, starts dancing, and let's set the scene. I had a button-down shirt on, a short-sleeve button-down.
Borrowed from Ted?
With no undershirt on.
Oh.
And next thing I know, this guy comes up to me, he's very physically close, and then tore my shirt open. And you hear, even amidst the thumping music, all of my buttons just clatter to the ground. I had two immediate thoughts.
Come here, you.
One, that was hot. Two, you asshole, you just ruined my shirt.
Give me yours.
He wasn't wearing a shirt, though. He was shirtless like Blake.
He didn't have it tucked into the back of his pants?
Nothing. He had nothing.
He lost it.
Suffice to say, it was a good thing I won a t-shirt from the concert that I had just previously attended just outside Roscoe's. So I threw that on.
You won a t-shirt?
Yeah. Oh, they were like throwing t-shirts out to the audience.
Oh, a t-shirt cannon.
Yeah. Not even really a cannon. It was more like someone was just chucking them out and I caught one. And it so happened to be my size too. So I was like, hey, this is great. Later on, near the end of the evening, I may or may not have seen this tweaked out twink doing things on the dance floor.
Ooh, I thought you were going to say that you found him in the washroom like Ted finds Blake in the washroom.
For all I know, by the time I left, that might have happened. But
did you ever see him again?
No, I know not the story of my own Blake. So Blake obviously is on crystal meth and he is tweaking out and he runs off and he says he's going to see Ted later.
Come on, dance with me.
I said no thanks. Or rather, Emmett.
I'll see you later.
Well, Emmett shoos him away.
Yeah.
And get out of here.
But we later find Ted going to the bathroom at Babylon, and he finds Blake passed out. I literally wrote at first that he found him dead. I thought he was dead.
He did look dead.
He had obviously had some sort of episode. I agree with Ted, him screaming at everyone who was just ignoring the body on the ground.
That didn't surprise me at all, though. I've seen that happen before, where people are just sort of not wanting to get involved in anything other than themselves.
Yeah,
at the moment. So they step over the drunk or the passed out Crystal Queen on the floor.
Well, and it was also very clear that all those people were also doing some sort of
drug as well.
So yeah, of course they can't be bothered to help Ted try and get this body off the ground and maybe save him.
Russell Mulcahy did this great shot while Blake is passed out on the floor. We get a shot above the floor, and then it just swoops down underneath the floor, and the floor is glass. And so you see Blake face down, kind of face stuck to the floor, drool coming out of his mouth. That was a great shot, and it drove home the fact that Blake is in rough shape at that moment. Brian has left Babylon and stops by the baths to do his normal thing.
He made it seem like when he's going to go to the baths, one, I can't pinpoint the moment that Brian said he was going to go to the baths to anyone, but next thing I know, we're at the bathhouse.
He didn't. He was on the dance floor, and he says that he's going to take off and call it an early night. Michael has that scene with him, and then Justin says, where are you going? Or where did he go? And that's where we get the clue in that he went to the baths.
Yeah, and there's something like he wanted like to have the seedy underbelly experience or something tonight or something like that. And he
got it, because that had to have been like the filthiest bathhouse in all of Pittsburgh.
I was surprised at how well lit it was for a bathhouse. I would have thought, you know,
are they normally darker?
Dark corners to me read bathhouse, because I feel like it's more about the anonymous encounters there. And what's interesting is that he, as Brian is walking his way through the halls of this bathhouse, he runs into I guess a bathhouse buddy.
Brian. Brings you to the ninth circle of hell.
I was reading Gorky and I got a taste for the lower depths.
See anything interesting?
A tall redhead in 27 with a black leather dildo.
Oh, him. Yeah. He's definitely a possibility for later.
Other than that, it's pretty much all markdowns.
Yeah, well, if you get into anything, you know, give me a holler. I'll be happy to stick a finger in your ass and suck on your balls while you're fucking him.
You're a real pal, Marty.
Marty.
One, props to the show for casting someone who is not of traditional body type that we've seen in this show.
Or age. Marty is clearly middle-aged.
Yeah, he's an older, he's a larger man. Like
furry.
And he's furry. And I'm like, I loved the detail that he was smoking a cigar in the room.
Oh, was he?
He had a cigar.
Oh, I didn't see that.
You think he was some sort of mob boss in the bathhouse.
Maybe he was.
He's the godfather of the bathhouses.
Yeah.
And I like that they had like a little interaction and talk about like what the pickings were like for the evening. So it's clear that one, Brian, you know, has some attendance at the bathhouses. And I mean, to the point where he even has like a regular buddy that I don't know if we ever see Marty again, but
I don't know. I know there's several more bathhouse scenes in the series. We'll have to keep an eye out for Marty.
Yeah, so he'll be like Todd at Babylon.
Did you look up who played Marty?
It was an actor named Joe Pinge or Ping, P-I-N-G-U-E. I mean, he's been in a lot of things as of late. He was in Pacific Rim. He was
in
the Book of Eli. He was in Orphan Black. He's been working very steadily. It looks like he's even on the new miniseries Godless, which I think is on Netflix. It looks like it's a regular. So yeah.
Marty, if you're out there and listening, let us know. We'd love to talk to you.
Yes. We want to know more about the bathhouse scene.
So Brian's trolling around the bathhouse. He gets a little hit of trail mix. Then he finds himself some action, and all of a sudden the lights are different. We were in the brightly fluorescent lit part of the bathhouse. Now we are in the blue light.
It's like blue dobby do bobby blue. Like it goes blue.
He sees off yonder in the distance a very nice looking butt on somebody that's wrapped in a towel. And that person's getting a little bit of jack off action, I think, or he was jacking off somebody.
I don't know. There was the handy happening.
Yeah. There's three people involved. And so Brian's thinking, okay, this looks like a more interesting time. So he goes over, says, take your towel off and stay a while. To which the guy says, I don't fuck. And he turns around and it's Matt's hero, Dr. David Cameron.
When you take off your towel, stay a while. I don't know, fuck. David.
I will freely admit I gasped when I saw that.
Really?
Yes.
You didn't expect it?
My jaw just dropped. I was like, whoa, what? You could hear that dun 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 kind of thing happening with this.
There was the expected line where Brian says, "What's up, Doc?" Then we cut to the hospital where Ted has apparently taken Blake. So Ted's checking him in. Emmett's there. He's trying to reason with Ted, but Ted's going to stay anyway.
And I mean, Emmett has good reason to again, protect Ted, because Ted has obviously done more for Blake than Blake did for Ted when Ted had his episode. You know,
yeah, this attachment that Ted had to Blake is interesting. It's almost as if in order for Ted to hook up with somebody, they have to be like dead in order for him to make this connection and to engage with. Everybody else that he engages with is other than Dale Wexler, the dungeon master. You know, they're all people that are going to turn him down or are going to dominate him. And here he's in a situation where he's in control. He has the ability to call the shots with Blake, because Blake, of course, is unconscious and still near heart attack with his crystal meth habit.
Yeah, I was intrigued by like why he felt
beholden to him, or
yes, what did he owe Blake? What did he owe him?
Yeah,
in this moment, maybe it's just that Ted has a big heart. I mean, obviously he does.
It's a little bit of like a reverse Florence Nightingale effect.
Yeah.
The next morning, Blake comes to in the hospital.
Oh, in like bed. A very like it was a shock to his system. You know, he snaps out of bed and he sees that Ted is holding his hand.
What's going on?
Sorry. Found myself sitting in a hospital room next to an unconscious person. Just seemed like the thing to do.
Hospital? Oh, yeah. That's only happened to me. All right.
You passed out at Babylon.
I did.
I found you laying unconscious on the bathroom floor.
I like that Ted had that attachment to him. Maybe it's something that I would have done like 10 years ago, but now it's just like, you're really no. Too much to handle.
No.
You bring a little baggage.
Oh, that's a lot of baggage that just happened.
One funny thing that I thought in this scene was that Ted carries lifesavers with him, because as soon as Blake wakes up and he's begging for candy, Ted says, "Lifesavers?"
Right. Oh,
like, and then lifesavers.
And then Blake is just like stuffing his mouth with
and
these
crunching
things.
Them too.
I'm like, you're not gonna have. I mean, you're already on meth. You're not gonna have any teeth left if you keep doing this.
But Blake has perfect teeth. So.
Right, for a meth head, his teeth are like.
Ted said one funny thing to Blake, which I thought was really, really, really naive and misguided, where he said,
"I just think you're this really sweet guy who has some problems and needs some help."
I'm going to stop. I am. I'm going to stop.
Whoa, yeah, you have some problems, all right.
You're an addict.
Yeah. It just seems so illogical to me, but we know that at this point, Ted thinks that he can fix him. He can take this raw good and turn it into a diamond. So it's a common theme with a character like Ted, where he thinks he can fix people versus, you know, obviously people have to fix themselves. You can't rely on Ted to fix you.
What is the cost for Ted to continue to give like that?
So let's back up a little to the night before at Dr. David's architecturally perfect mid-century modern home. Michael's already in bed, which got me thinking. It's like, how did all this time get compressed? So Brian leaves Babylon, goes to the bathhouse. Michael leaves Babylon and goes home. What time is it? Because you'd think that you're going to the bathhouse at what, 2? Seems like right. A good idea around that time. What time did Brian leave? So
didn't Brian said he was making an early night of it.
So you think that they were at Babylon at 8 o'clock?
Maybe 11.
Maybe I'm analyzing this too literally, where it's like, how did they like, how did Ferris Bueller cram all that into one day?
But the big thing I noticed is that when Dr. David Cameron comes home, he gets super aggressive with Michael.
He's hungry and thirsty.
Right, because I'm assuming that, you know, the handy was going really well. And then when Brian showed up, he had obviously stopped before he could get off. And so he's like, I gotta take care of this now.
Yeah, and he pounces on Michael and is just like starting to rip him apart. Then that scene ended, unfortunately. It would have been fun to see what else happened. So the next morning, we're at Debbie's house.
Christ, didn't you hear me call you for the last 10 minutes?
I know you think because I'm young, I can just tumble out of bed and look like this.
Well, I don't know why not. I tumble out of bed and look like this.
Debbie had a shirt on that said, I love fags.
it was a great little detail as she's like yelling for Justin to come downstairs for breakfast. And she just casually has that I love fags shirt.
Yeah. This is the scene where we're finding out if Justin's going to get into the Pittsburgh Academy of Fine Arts or whatever.
Pittsburgh Institute of Fine Arts.
Yeah.
IFA.
The local art school. They've got the letter. There's this curious juxtaposition going on that this moment is happening with Debbie and Vic instead of Craig and Jennifer Taylor, Justin's parents. So I thought that was pretty meaningful that Justin is having this big major moment with his new family in the gay community versus his real family, the lovely Jennifer Taylor.
Let's say instead
the
of
asshole
real,
Craig no, Taylor.
Instead of real family, I would say his blood family.
Okay.
Let's go with that. Because I think just as much Vic and Debbie and Brian and Emmett and Ted and to a tinier degree Michael are also very much a real family for him too. But yeah, it's a great point. I mean, that's a milestone in a young person's life.
In a teenager's life.
Yeah. Opening.
Just in the teenager.
Opening whether or not you're accepted. And I love, you know, and they use the sort of like.
It comes in the mail.
A typical suspenseful build to whether or not he got accepted, you know, and mm-hmm. he can't open the letter and it's up to Debbie.
She just grabs a butter knife and rips it open.
Well, and she sells it like it's not good news. And
yeah, what a dick. Debbie, it's like, don't play with him that way.
I mean, come on. There's no other way of doing it. And I love that like Yahoo that Vic lets out. I think that's the
loudest and most amount of energy we've heard from Vic in a while.
I probably had to go take a nap. Yeah, he took a nap right after that.
We haven't had a social gym visit in a while, have we?
No, it's been a minute.
Yeah, so everybody goes to the gym together, and Michael's telling the story of Dr. David ravishing him the night before, which, as we know, it's after he came back from the bathhouse. Brian is telling his story of the bathhouse, and then Emmett chimes in with his own story of fucking somebody at the bathhouse.
Yes. Oh, my God.
Last time I was at the bath?
Of course. Years ago.
Of course.
I was in L.A. visiting my friend Shelley. Anyway, there was this cubicle at the end of the hall, and the door's open, so I go in. And at first I can't really see anything, you know, because it's dark and I don't have my contacts in. Anyway, there's this guy lying there on his stomach with his butt up in the air, just screaming, fuck me, fuck me. So I did, and afterwards I caught a glimpse of his face. It was.
No shit. You fuck him. So she really is his beard.
They don't call her whiskers for nothing.
The clues here that Emmett was giving led me to think that he was talking about Tom Cruise as the guy that Emmett fucked in the LA bathhouse. Did you get that?
I didn't understand the clues to it. He said they don't call it whiskers for nothing. And I'm like, is that a reference to something?
I think it was Michael's line where he said, so she really is his beard. And that's what made me think that. Because I think the timing would have been right for Tom Cruise to be birthing Surrey Cruise around then, right?
No. At the time, so this is 2001, he would be,
we might have to look this up. Well, our knowledge of Tom Cruise is lacking.
Well, because then I know in 2001, he released Vanilla Sky, and that was around the time he was with Penelope Cruz.
Oh, okay.
So, now granted, we cannot confirm nor deny such rumors.
Yeah.
So, but based on the writing, we are making an assumption that they are talking about a A-list Hollywood actor.
In 2001.
Yes.
So that was just a cute little subplot going on. According to Emmett, he terms Blake the angel of death when Ted starts talking about him. And we find out that Ted took Blake home with him.
Yeah. So what we had seen at the hospital is Blake reveals that he was evicted and he was living with friends, and but not the kind of friends that would be responsible ones, which told me he's probably staying in some sort of drug infested, you know, living situation, which is why he's in the predicament that he is in. Ted, taking pity on Blake, takes him in.
Do you think it's a little weird that Ted goes from the hospital, checks Blake out of the hospital, brings him to his house, dumps him in his bedroom, and then hits the gym?
Yes. Someone who is clearly going about to go through withdrawal, you're going to leave in your house with no supervision.
Yeah.
That made
the guy that put you into a coma
sense to me.
The
plus,
first time he's in your house.
And we know, like, even today, the crystal meth use in the gay community is astounding. Like, ugh. Nothing has changed in 17 years.
I don't know. It seems like it's kind of like the older man's game now. So I don't know too many twinks or guys in their early 20s that are into that.
I mean,
that.
My story is 3-4 years old, so I don't think much has changed. If anything, I find it that it's more prevalent, especially if you look at so many apps as of late.
I'm like lucky to go skiing tonight.
And you're like, what? Like, what does that mean? Or the amount of people who have to put the warning in front of...
No PNP.
No PNP stuff. And it's like
420 fine, though.
It is, Patrick.
Okay.
And so the fact that we now have to continue to put those kind of warnings, like, if you are into that, don't even bother with me. That's a scary
thought.
That's a good
point. It makes you wonder, like, how many people message you on Grindr that are like, let's hook up. By the way, let's do some PMP.
No. I'm not going anywhere near you.
Yeah. Angel of death. Emmett was right. We should listen to Emmett more often. So Brian seemed to be the only one in that scene that was at all amused that Ted had adopted Blake at that moment. He had predictable smirks and smiles and stuff. Everybody else was like, Ted, this is terrible. This is awful. What are you thinking? What are you doing? And Brian's just loving it. And I kind of like that sinisterness to Brian in that scene. Elsewhere at the Taylor family estate in suburbia, this was a full exterior scene. They never went in the house. They must not have been able to secure the location for that day. So they were just shooting it in the driveway.
The way I justified it is because Justin was kicked out that he probably isn't allowed inside.
Oh, that could be. I just thought that they didn't have the budget.
Well, probably that too. But I like to give the backstory, the given circumstances for Jennifer to not invite her son in. Was that
she let the realtor in, but not Justin?
Yes, there is a realtor at the home. When Justin stops by to speak with Jennifer about him being accepted into art school, but she brings up a point of, like, you know, are you sure you want to give up Dartmouth?
Yeah, she wasn't at all that in favor of it at first. She liked that she had a creative son that had artistic talent. She didn't like that he wasn't going to Dartmouth.
But what about Dartmouth?
Well, I'll just write them. I'll tell them I'm not going.
Justin, your dad's expecting you to go.
Because he went there?
Oh, sweetheart. I know how much you want to be an artist. Do you have any idea how hard it is to make a living?
Yeah. It's what I want to do. It's what I've always wanted to do.
As every parent's struggle, they wonder how is their child going to live given whatever profession they decide to study. And she has real world concerns, quote unquote, real world concerns about Justin trying to make it as an artist. And that's why she feels like Dartmouth means you might have more stability, which I get it. But
yeah, and that,
also
that provides a central conflict for Justin in this episode. So he goes back and forth at least 3 or 4 times between going to one or the other. And we see the stakes increasing for him each time. This is the first time that the stakes go up, where he finds out that his parents are getting a divorce. He starts to believe that it has everything to do with him, that he caused it.
Well, and this is where I want to be like, Justin, you didn't cause this. Jennifer got woke and said, screw this man, I'm out, and I applaud her for it. I literally had written down Jennifer splitting up with that asshole. And I was so proud of her, even though it's hard.
I thought this was a really strange way to tell your child that you're getting a divorce. They were in the driveway having an accidental meeting. You'd think that somebody of Jennifer Taylor's caliber, we admire her greatly, would have had a better plan.
Well, she was caught off guard by the whole situation because you have this realtor showing up and she's explaining to Justin, well, we're putting the house up for sale. And, you know, I think she was looking for a way, but at some point you got to like rip the Band-Aid off.
That's bad planning on her part.
Well, of course it was bad planning. It wasn't planned at all. So I can't say it was bad planning because she was kind of, the situation was put in front of her.
I agree. I just wish that there would have been a little more drama, a little bit more of a moment between Jennifer and Justin. Because we love Jennifer Taylor so much and we love her character, the way that her character is written. Here it was just a quickie and I was just hoping for more. Back at the diner, Dr. David is pouring it on thick for Michael. He's in full-on, I was going to say sugar daddy mode. No, he's in full-on, like, boyfriend, lover, partner mode with him.
Well, and then Brian shows up with the dramatic tension, of course, that he knows what Dr. David Cameron was doing.
That's where this tension really made the episode or the scene interesting. I like that Brian has the upper hand in the conversation and is having fun with it. And Dr. David is just getting more and more petrified as it goes.
I wouldn't say he was having fun because I think he's now given the ammo in which he can wreck Dr. David Cameron, but he's refraining, which I thought was interesting.
Yeah, he wasn't going to do anything to hurt Michael, but he wanted to get his digs in and make it clear to Dr. David
that he's got to step up. He's got to step up and...
He put him on notice there. Yeah,
like, hey, guess what? This isn't going to last long. So I think in his own way, Brian was saying, either you tell him or I will tell him.
They had that scene after they had stepped out onto the street. And something that I'd noticed about this scene is the exterior of the diner looked all boarded up and it was like dark. It didn't have any of the life that the diner normally sees.
Looking at the scene again, I mean, it had, I don't know if it was just because it seemed like all of the shades were closed.
Yeah.
And maybe that's what you're talking about.
They just threw the rainbow flag up on the wall and called it the diner. It looked like an abandoned building. They needed this pickup shot between Brian and David, and they didn't really want to spend the budget on doing a full dressing exterior of the diner. So these kind of winged it
and said, diner, it's done.
Yeah, it was like kind of the second episode or second scene where it just seemed like the budget was missing for it. It's like, let's have this dramatic scene in the Taylor family driveway. Let's have this other one in front of the diner that's all boarded up and dark. The only thing that did have some life was Ted's condo, where Blake is suddenly a chef.
Oh my God, that meal looked amazing.
Yeah, Ted comes in. He seems to be enjoying this whole boyfriend experience going on. He had somebody to come home to for the first time.
Yes, he had a meal that was being cooked. I found it a little enjoyable that Blake was obviously wearing Ted's clothes. I mean, you know, because it obviously didn't have much on him at the hospital. But yeah, the meal and it was like Blake trying to repay Ted. But also to say, also, I'm still very into you.
It was also a little bit of, I don't have anywhere else to go. I got to like do this one upright.
And yeah, I've got to show that I can be helpful.
Yeah, it's like the, you know, when you're fostering a pet or something and the pet is doing its best not to like chew up the house because the pet wants to stay. Nathan can stay.
And there's a moment between them where Blake is pouring a glass of water.
Oh, yeah.
THB. You ever use it? Just water.
And it's very triggering for Ted because the last time that happened, he ended up in a coma.
Don't drink anything from Blake. Well, let alone eat the full meal.
And then Blake, you know, reassures it's just water. And they sort of have this intimate moment and eventually consummate said relationship.
I did like how I think Blake had told Ted to put some music on. And so Ted puts on La Traviata and starts explaining the opera to Blake, basically casting him into the same opera. And that plants a, a cute little seed of operatic enjoyment in Blake. It's like, what's the line from Pretty Woman? It's like most people's impression of opera the first time is very dramatic. And it was a cute scene. I think here we're rooting for Ted and
yet still very wary of Blake.
Yeah, there's only one way that this is going to end, but you're kind of watching Ted accelerate towards the brick wall, and you want the best for him, but you know that this guy's bad news. And you know that he's going to do something bad.
Right. I mean, didn't you think that it was a ruse of some sort that Blake is basically buttering Ted up?
When I first watched this episode years and years ago, I definitely thought that. I've watched it maybe a half dozen times since. So when I watch it now, it's with a very different lens. I see more Ted's side, whereas the first time that I watched it, I saw a little more conniving in Blake for that scene. So it's interesting that the scene can be played off two different ways. But either way, you still see that this is going to end weird. There's only one way that this can go.
It's not good. It's not bad. It's just...
Yeah, it's just there.
Well, I believe this is the now time of the episode for a lesbian interlude.
Yeah, the required lesbian interlude scene. Justin mysteriously shows up at the lesbian's house. What was he doing there? Does he just kind of wander around the neighborhood and visit people? Did he have a reason for being there?
Again, chosen family. They probably have all started to get the news that he was accepted. And especially with, we know Lindsay to be somewhat of an artist.
Yep.
So what better way for them to celebrate than to them for Mel and Lindsay, who are, again, are now back together. Mel's back at the house. Guillaume is, I assume, in France.
Guillaume.
The French dude is now...
He's been deported.
He has been deported because they sort of left him in the dust. And what better way to celebrate Justin's acceptance than to give him a really cool gift, I thought.
I thought it was a little unusual because Justin's only been in these people's lives for like, what, 6 months?
And he's sort of heavily involved, though. I think he's
spent the night there at the
on more than one occasion. Right?
There's a little bit of unseen adoption going on where I think they're starting to kind of take care of him. He's their his own go-to like center. Whenever something weird is going on in his life, he kind of stops by there to recharge. He says, thanks for the gift, but I'm going to Dartmouth. And he just closes the lid on it. It's like, you need to learn how to accept gifts, young man.
Now, granted, he doesn't know how to accept this gift because he's reeling from the fact that his parents are getting divorced. So he's carrying the guilt of that. So he feels the only way that he can step up to the plate, as it were, is to go to Dartmouth, do what's expected of him. Now, I'm curious, Patrick, to know what you think of this sort of switch that he's made. We know that he wants to be an artist. He's always wanted to be an artist. I feel like he would like, in order to continue the big fuck you to his dad, he would not want to go to Dartmouth and not live up to that expectation.
I think that some of this back and forth that goes on with him is a little either bipolar or schizophrenic because he's kind of changing his mind back and forth, back and forth, back and forth. I think ultimately, though, he's trying to salvage his family life. So whenever a teenager causes all this disruption to the family, there is often a following period where they try to fix it, where they try to make everything better, even kind of subconsciously knowing full well that they're not going to be able to. So I think this is his moment where he thinks that he can restore his family back to what they were originally if he would just go to Dartmouth and make his dad happy. So he's kind of has two masters here. He has his own instincts and his own talent mixed with a desire to heal the family. And we can't forget about his mysterious little sister that's not even
mentioned.
Yeah.
But again, why would he care about satisfying his dad?
I think it's more of a yearning for what once was. It has less to do with his dad's dickish behavior, you know, attacking Brian with the car, for example, and punching him a couple times and wanting to send him to military school. It's more of an idealized version of what he thinks his home life should be. And he kind of wants that back. But as we see a couple more times in this episode, he flip-flops back and forth, changes his mind, and he's really fighting off the two different ideals. This was an interesting storyline that they put into him. Some of the writing, like the lesbian scene, was a little crammed in because the purpose of this scene was for him to say, I'm not going to art school. I'm going to Dartmouth. And to have a trained art teacher say, no, you got real talent. That's all the scene really was. And we cut away from that and go to a very different storyline, which is the downfall of your beloved Dr. David.
And Dr. David Cameron is sitting there.
Not reading. He's got the book open. He's just kind of staring into space.
But he confesses that he went to the baths.
While Michael is sitting on the sofa. So Michael sits down on the sofa next to him. They cuddle up. He puts the book down. And Dr. David says, we need to talk about something. And then he lays it on and says what he did. And there's this very, very nice piece of direction here where Michael slowly was withdrawing physically from Dr. David on the sofa until they were completely apart. It was really subtle and it was very, very well shot.
I went to the bath.
What were you doing now?
Mostly walking around. Look, it's not something I do a lot, Michael. It's the first time since we've been together that I've been there.
I don't want to talk about
it. No, I thought you should know.
What, that you're fucking around?
I don't fuck.
And then you come back here and you fuck me? If you gave me anything.
No, I said I don't fuck.
Because I would assume that right. Since they are living together, they are not practicing safe sex.
I think you have to live together for that, right? I've heard.
Yes.
I read in Us magazine. You just gave me this weird, I said Us magazine. You're like, the fuck are you talking about?
It's like, who reads?
Sorry, it's Us Weekly.
Us Weekly.
Yeah. No. There was one in the lobby of the studio today. I just leafed through it while I was waiting for you.
So Michael's anger and...
He was just physically and emotionally repulsed by Dr. David.
Because we've seen him have the opposite response to people who come on to him. He's like, no, I'm in a relationship. He would freak out if I ever did anything. I'm shut down.
The interesting thing, though, that you had talked about a minute ago is... What was Dr. David doing at the baths? I mean, what if he says he's not going to fuck there and he says, well, it's mostly I just jerk off and watch. That's like kind of a weird character flaw in this guy. He goes someplace like that to watch and jack off. Meanwhile, he fought so hard to get Michael to move in with him. It was very strange for this character to be doing that. You would think that it might have been the other way around. You would think that Michael would be the one that would be lured into the back room of Babylon or something like that.
And he almost was at the beginning of this episode.
Yeah.
But it's like, it made me question what went on in the previous relationships with Dr. David Cameron. Because he said like this was the first time he had gone there during their relationship.
Yeah.
So something tells me this is a pattern.
He has a monthly membership, I'm sure.
But this is the point of the idea of monogamy in relationships, especially today. They're constantly in question. Is monogamy something that can truly be upheld by people? Is it better to just have the frank conversation and say, so I know I'm human. I may slip up. Can we promise each other that either these are the rules, or if this happens, this is how we move forward from it. Instead, we see probably what's more traditional.
Yeah, I don't know. I've never understood nor participated in an open relationship. It just doesn't work for me. I've never bought that line that we're going to be happier if we fuck other people. I just don't get that.
Well, and see, I have many close friends who are in open relationships. They have a clear set of boundaries.
What are the boundaries?
Well, I mean, it's different for every couple.
What's an example?
If you find
if
you find someone that you want to sleep with, you are going to always wear a condom. You will always ask first.
I would not want to be part of that conversation.
if those are the clear set of rules you have set from the beginning and you follow those, then that shows that you have enabled a very deep understanding of trust in the relationship so that you can trust your partner to go off and do things like that because they know that it will feel good, but you know that they are always coming home to you.
On this one limited case, I am on Team Michael. I like that he just wants this one relationship at a time without physicality with other people. He sums it up later in the episode where he talks about how when he's hooking up with the hunky guy, and we'll talk about
Hunkalicious,
that. Hunkalicious. We'll talk about that a little bit more once we get to that scene. I liked that Michael had these moments where he was saying, I didn't want my dick in his mouth. I related more to Michael in this particular scene.
Now, and I'm in agreement too. I know that personally for me, I could never really do an open relationship. That said, I acknowledge that for those that do have open relationships, they can make it work. And I've seen it work. And these people have been together for years. I applaud that they're able to find that balance of trust in their relationships.
I have noticed on some of the apps, particularly on Chappie, not so much on Grindr, but a lot of
you're
people.
You're on Chappie?
Hey, now.
Is Chappie going to sponsor us?
Chappie, if you'd like to sponsor the show, hit us up. We'll talk. I have noticed an increasingly larger number of people that say that they don't want to be part of like open relationships or something like that. That if you're in one, I'm not interested in talking to you. And I've started to see that more and more. And I found that interesting that it's almost a like retrograde from what we'd seen before, which was a lot of promiscuity and a lot of open relationships. It almost seems like it's kind of going the opposite direction these days.
Well, and this is a great way to segue into the following scene, which takes place in Emmett's apartment in Michael's old apartment.
It's basically the conversation we just had.
Yeah, it's basically the conversation we had where the question of being gay and how that ties to the inability to be monogamous. Are we just men who just have to fuck, or is there a way that we can honor what one would say is a traditional one-on-one relationship? And I think it's a fascinating question because I think there are multiple answers to it.
Show him you're too good for him, but he doesn't deserve it.
And who does Michael deserve? Someone who will cherish him. Who will be faithful. Someone for whom he will be the sun and the moon and the stars.
What fucking Betty Davis movie are you living in? And what did you think would happen, that you'd be monogamous forever?
Ugh, that is so like you, like some vile homophobic crack.
Homophobic?
Yes, but just because we're gay, it's impossible for us to have a loving, loyal relationship?
Not because we're gay, because we're men.
It's no different for straight guys. I read somewhere that something like 64% of them admit they've been unfaithful.
I wouldn't know. I've only slept with 32% of them.
What, so I'm supposed to let David do whatever he wants? Whoever he wants?
I didn't say that. Maybe you should establish some rules, you know? Decide what's acceptable and what's not.
I don't think I can do that.
Well, that's fine. Then you can move back in here. End it all over a hand job.
I could never shame someone who decides that they can do an open relationship and they manage to have a successful one.
Yeah, I just feel like they're not willing to do the work for a monogamous relationship, that it's just easier to do something else.
Oh, see, I disagree that it's them not doing work. I think it is just as much work to maintain a relationship like that. I don't think it's just saying, oh,
it sounds like extra work.
No, exactly. I think it's just as hard or harder, but it's because they know that there might be physical needs that are not met. And if that means they're meeting it elsewhere, but there's no emotional attachment to it, or, you know, that they know that it is a purely physical thing, that's okay. And I don't think that that means that they're demeaning their primary relationship in any way.
But don't you think that a physical need can be met without somebody else? You can meet a physical need by yourself.
I mean, no. I
don't see it as a need to bang somebody else. No, I see it as a need to get off. But
again,
you don't have to
disagree.
Deal with somebody
else. And I don't think it's right to hold someone's relationship compared to another one that's manages to be monogamous. And I'm also on the camp of Dan Savage, who says that I'm not going to be the one to judge that.
I am. The premise of this story that we have here is that it's two people that had different ideas about the relationship.
I will concede this point to you, that Dr. David Cameron has set up a relationship that was very idealized.
Oh, yeah, definitely.
He has broken that.
It was all his idea from
exactly.
The beginning.
And he has broken that idealized feeling, especially considering how he reacted when Michael wanted to go out to Babylon and do things with Brian, especially.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, that's right. Because he fought the hardest to get those two separated.
So to then be caught having another physical interaction at a bathhouse of all places.
Right.
This makes him a bit of a hypocrite.
The mighty have fallen. One thing that I thought was interesting is that Emmett was strangely in favor of Michael cutting Dr. David loose because he was an early proponent of this relationship. As soon as Dr. David wanted to bed down and nest with Michael, Emmett was all in favor of that. Now he's like, cut him off. Get rid of him here.
They're having that debate as well. I think Emmett is one who is a romantic and thinks that monogamy is the way to go. Brian, as shown with his relationship, whether or not he calls it a relationship with Justin, I mean, they fuck whoever.
Yeah. At this point, they don't have ground rules. They come up with some eventually, but for the moment, they are very wide open. And I don't even think they either of them call it a relationship yet. So that's an interesting parallel that we see here. There was this interesting moment where Brian gives Dr. David credit.
I know he told you the truth, and I've got to give him credit. I was sure he wouldn't.
He says that to Michael as they're leaving, and he just had to slip in that he knew about it.
This was, I agree. I think this was a fascinating scene. And I appreciated Brian in some way sticking up for Dr. David Cameron because he could have easily have continued the lie.
Yeah. And after Brian explained it, how did Michael not connect those dots where he knew that Brian went to the bathhouse? Dr. David tells him that he went to the bathhouse. How did Michael not make that connection that maybe they ran into each other?
I thought that was a bit of a weak link in the plot of a storyline. You know, you could argue that it's Michael was just so blinded by the fact that Dr. David Cameron lied to him.
The note that I wrote down, and you have a copy of my notes in front of you, was, here's proof that Brian isn't trying to manipulate Michael. Take that, Matt.
Oh, one instance.
Well, this is, I'm going
to
keep a
in
list.
In all of the episodes prior to this, there is ample evidence of that. But in this instance, yes, he calls it out right away, saying like, if I had told you, this is what you would have thought. But so, that's one.
Ted needs to get some gas in his car. So he pulls into a gas station that looks like it's from like maybe 1984 and realizes that his wallet is missing. And in the background, we hear that same aria from La Traviata. Ted and everybody else is just 100% sure that Blake took his wallet.
The pieces of the puzzle are there. Meth addict that we can't necessarily for sure say is 100% recovered is taken in because he has nothing to a nice little condo. The evidence can pile up very easily for Blake to have robbed him. So
Ted's searching the condo for it, and he's, you know, like throwing the sofa cushions out of the way and finds a condom under the sofa. And I wrote down like, really? Ted doesn't have condoms that he lost under the sofa.
Well, I think it was a wrapper. I don't think it was an act. I don't think it was
even worse.
It was, well, they started their action in the living room. So I'm not wholly surprised.
About that. Yeah. Maybe it was with Blake.
Oh, I think it's 100% was with Blake.
Who do you think topped who?
You know, I think Ted would have topped Blake.
That's what I was thinking.
Because I think Ted can only be submissive to Dale Wexler.
The Dungeon Master.
Yeah. And then it also makes me wonder if that, because he's his suck pig, if he had to ask permission.
I was waiting to figure out how you're going to work in
from
that
from his
word.
Dom, from his master, in order to sleep with Blake. I wonder if that conversation happened.
So when this scene was playing out, you thought that Blake took the wallet, right?
Oh, God, that's a hard question. I feel like it was very easy for us. Well, actually, you know what? No, you're right. Because I literally wrote, Blake robbed Ted. So, yeah, because again, the evidence was very easily able to pin it on him.
Ted is just starting to boil over here. In his mind, he thinks that Blake took it. So he's just exploding over it.
Well, and he did all of this defending of Blake and saying like why he had taken him in, and then to sort of see him proven wrong, especially when Blake comes in to have purchased another opera. Was it a CD collection or something for Ted, which I thought was very sweet. But, you know, it's very easy for him to say, you stole my money to do this. I couldn't get a hold of you.
Get the fuck out.
Yeah.
So Debbie's house, we have Justin and Debbie. This really, really intense scene where Debbie had found a lot of Justin's artwork in the trash.
I've taken out the garbage. It's amazing what you find in the garbage, even your own. And look what I found. Huh? Luckily, I retrieved it before the patina of my pesto from last night got all over.
I don't want them.
You don't want them?
That's why I threw them away.
But these are works of art. I mean, look at this. Look at this one. I mean, you could frame them.
Then you keep them. I'm giving it up.
Hold it. Get your bubble butt back here.
Justin's giving up art school to go to Dartmouth. So this is pivot number three in Justin's arc about, is he going? Where is he going? Where was he going to? This scene was, I think, a big departure for Justin because he so far had been his own man. He had been making his own decisions. He stood up for himself at all points. He had hosted a protest with Senator Baxter on the steps of his school. He had his locker burned. Now he's doing what his parents want. And I thought that was a very strange move for Justin, but it was necessary to keep this back and forth going. I just thought that it was very out of character for him.
I'd agree. I think it's, again, why would he care so fucking much about his dad to want to give that up? And
that's what Debbie's telling him.
Yeah. And, you know, Debbie's on the right path. It's about, you know, Justin has to be able to live his life. And he's done so well so far about coming out, living his truth. He clearly has the support of everybody else in his chosen family. So, yeah, he should continue to follow the path that he feels is right for him, not for his family.
Yeah, and this scene was the opportunity for one more person to say, dude, you're making like a really bad choice here. Meanwhile, Michael is at what had to have been the scariest cruising forest in all of Pittsburgh.
I thought it was a cemetery. I thought those were tombstones or sarcophagi or something.
It's the middle of winter. Why did they have to go to an outdoor park for their hookup?
Right, and that's the other thing. I'm like, are they going to do this in public? So Michael calls Hunkalicious, and I loved Hunkalicious's scarf. I was a big fan of that.
Wasn't it like an orange plaid thing?
Yeah, I thought it was really cute. It was very fall. I'm very into it. And, you know, we're left with the two of them just furiously making out outdoors.
Yeah, that's it for the moment. Back at Emmett's flat, Ted is starting to have second thoughts about his diatribe on Blake, and he feels bad about it. And Emmett is glad that this guy's gone, that he's out of his friend's life. He's trying to give Ted some backbone about this guy's bad news. It's good that he's gone. You did your good deed for the day. Now let's go to Babylon.
Can we also talk about the different things that Emmett was wearing to get ready?
Oh, yeah, that top that he had on with the
peekaboo
the panel.
Yeah, the clear panel so you could see his pecs.
Yeah.
I quite enjoyed that. So they decide they're going to go to Babylon, but just before they leave,
ta-da,
Ted finds his wallet.
What's that?
Oh, nothing. Just my wallet.
So we head to Babylon, still on the heels of that, and Ted feeling like absolute shit and saying like, I have to go and find him. And Brian, oh, this joke was just, I was like, oh, too soon.
I loved it.
I gotta find him. Apologize.
You should look on the bathroom floor. Fuck you.
I'm glad Ted didn't waste any time. He snapped right back with that fuck you. And I was, that's right, because that was just rude.
There was a really intense scene between Brian and Justin here as Brian is setting Justin straight about his so far choice to go to Dartmouth versus art school versus being his own man and following his own path. This scene was really nice. I liked it. It got a little corny here and there, but I liked that Brian was really just pushing Justin's reset button and resetting him back to that risk-taking little twink that was 17 that went home with 28-year-old Brian Kinney 17 episodes ago. And it was useful because it made Justin see that going to Dartmouth is not me. I'm doing it for the wrong reasons. I'm not going to do that. This scene was really good. And in the background, they're on the dance floor. Forever Young is playing.
Oh, that was really great music choice.
Really, really good. We watched the Netflix one for comparison, and the scene was ruined.
And immediately turned it off.
Yeah, we did. So all was right with the world.
With Brian and Justin, at least.
And I did like that. I mentioned this a little bit earlier tonight, that Brian has stopped mocking Justin all the time. It used to be every time Justin would walk into a scene, Brian would make some catty comment about him, like, where's your bicycle? Oh, it's the cast from Zoom.
Well, and stuff like that. As we heard in the last episode, it was time for Brian to choose another tactic.
I just liked it. I like seeing Brian as his protector and cheerleader now, and I'm liking this fully integrated Justin. At the architecturally perfect mid-century modern home, Dr. David is going crazy and reorganizing the house. He did CDs, DVDs, the medicine cabinet. Where the fuck were you, Michael?
And I'm like, first of all, you have a lot of nerve to ask that question, Dr. David Cameron. Yeah. And
you're so harsh on him now.
It's because they didn't have the conversation. So here Michael starts to say, I met with someone, and he starts to give detail of the hookup. It's obviously Ian and Dr. David Cameron.
Did you think that Michael was all of a sudden put together here? Like, normally he's almost at a loss for words. He can't quite string his feelings together into phrases. Here, he had all the answers. And one of the notes I wrote down that he seemed to be kind of parroting everything that he'd heard from Brian, Emmett, and Ted, but not quite. He really understood himself and how he felt here. And that's something new for Michael.
It was a moment of growth. I think it took an incident like this for him to wake up, try and understand what it is he wants, and finally have the backbone that it took 18 episodes for him to find, and confront and say, here are the problems I had with what you did, and here is why I did what I did and why I stopped.
This was a very pivotal scene for the Michael and Dr. David relationship, and it's starting to head towards something. I'm looking forward to see where this goes in the next few episodes.
And yeah, and it was that reconciliation of them acknowledging that they're human and that this will be a thing that they can overcome shows that there is real strength that can be found in what they want with each other.
Yeah, that storyline tied up pretty nicely at the end. So it wouldn't be a Russell Mulcahy directed episode unless it ended with a music video. So at Debbie's house, we're in Justin's bedroom, which is actually Michael's bedroom, and he's printing out on his word processor his Dartmouth letter.
I guess back in 2001, you had to actually type a letter and send that in to say that you accepted.
A little bit of a plot device there.
I mean, I think I was accepted, and I think they knew I was going there when I sent in the check. Like...
Well, what we see here is Justin is suddenly inspired to draw his jean jacket, which is hanging from the door. So in a matter of seconds, he's completely whipped up a fully shaded pencil sketch of his jacket hanging up on the door. We see that he's making his decision that he's really not going to go to Dartmouth. He doesn't say it. We don't know what happened to that letter so much. But we start to realize that, yeah, he made that journey, and he's going to be his own man there. In the background to this Russell Mulcahy music video was a song by Queen. It was called A Kind of Magic. It pulled the scene together nicely, and I love how Russell Mulcahy directs these musical interludes. It tied up the episode really nicely. It was a nice little upbeat. Credits rolled with the Queen song playing underneath it. Good episode.
It was a really great way to tie up the Justin storyline, but also wrap up the episode. Like, it was just, it ended with such an energy and such a drive.
Yeah.
Even though he was just sketching his jacket.
Yeah. And we have no idea where Blake is. Blake's out in the wild. He's been cut loose. So does this episode still hold up, Matt?
I am going to say yes.
Really?
And I really do. I think there were a couple of big things. One, I think the depiction of Blake's addiction and the dangerous habits of crystal meth in the gay community are still incredibly prevalent, as we've discussed. I also think the way they dealt with the complex nature of Dr. David Cameron's indiscretion within Michael's and his relationship was incredibly truthful, and a conversation that is very nuanced, especially in the way that we can look at contemporary relationships, both gay and straight. And I appreciated that they could have easily have been like, oh, he cheated on him, that's the end, kind of like the way they did with the Mel and Lindsay situation. Even though they worked it out and got back together. But here it's like, they know this was an indiscretion. Here's how we're going to work it out and push through. So for those couple of reasons, I definitely felt like the episode held up.
For me, I'm a yes too. I don't know as that I've actually said no on any of these. I've given like a soft yes and I've given a split decision. I don't think I've gone with a hard no. So there were some things in this episode that clearly dated it. Like CDs, but the themes are still there. Parents getting a divorce, kids thinking that it's their fault, trying to decide which university to go to, how to save a meth head, cheating on your partner. These are all things that we still deal with today. So I'm a yes on this one as well. So two yeses this time for episode 18, Surprise Kill, directed by Russell Mulcahy.
Join us next week for number 19, entitled Good Grief.
Until then, I am Patrick Randall.
And I'm Matt Dominguez.
Thanks for listening. Leave a like, share with a friend, and subscribe so you don't miss our next episode. Still, Queer as Folk was written and performed by Patrick Randall and Matt Dominguez. Made with love in Chicago.
Hey, Todd, how's it going?
Fine.